from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette, and this is Idaho Matters. There's a nasty strain of a highly contagious, drug-resistant ringworm, and it's impacting a part of the United States. So what does this mean for the rest of us? We're going to answer that question for you today. We have Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System, joining us. And remember, if you have a public health question, send it to us, Idaho Matters, at boisestate.edu. Hi, Dr. Pate.
Hi, Gemma.
Okay, Dr. Pate, I mean, seriously, every single time I think we're moving on, something new comes up. So, not to be flip about this, but first off, I mean, tell us what ringworm is. And then this, I guess, new strain of it.
Yes. So ringworm is actually not caused by a worm or a parasite. It is caused by a fungus. And, you know, probably many of the listeners out there who are parents have had kids with ringworm. And it's usually not a big deal. They get a rash. It typically is roundish or ovalish, and it oftentimes will kind of be a little bit raised around the edges. It'll look oftentimes a little scaly, but it's superficial because this fungus, the part of the skin that it invades, is one of those top layers. It doesn't get down in deep in the skin ordinarily. Mm-hmm. And so and it tends to be limited. Generally, children will just have, you know, one area most commonly, and it usually responds very quickly, days to weeks, with creams that are commonly used. And mm-hmm. that medical name for that fungus is Trichophyton rubra. It's been around, you know, for many, many, many decades. The one that you're talking about is a different species of that same family of fungus, Trichophyton, but this one is called Endotinii, and we've known about it for about a decade. It is relatively a newly discovered fungus. It has emerged particularly in the Southeastern Asian countries, and we've been on alert that it does appear to not respond to these common creams that we use. And so we've been on the lookout, but we really haven't seen it over the past decade until a case was just identified in New York. And it was identified because in this person, instead of having that one patch, as is typical, there were patches all over this person's body, which is distinctly unusual, and it was not responding to these creams that we use. Mm-hmm. So one would, in that situation, you would think that either the patient is immunocompromised or the fungus is resistant. And in fact, it was determined it's this new species from that we know is in the Southeastern Asian countries. And when they started looking around, they found one other case. So we've got two cases that have been identified and reported. The thing that is a little bit concerning is that one of those patients did not have a travel history. And so what that means is that instead of having traveled over to that area where there are cases, this person must have been exposed in the United States, which what that tells me is there are more cases of this than just those two. And so even though it is resistant to these creams, thank God we do have other medications that we don't like to use because they're more expensive, they have more side effects potentially, but we do have medications. And those two patients have been treated with these newer medications that are ingested instead of applied to the skin. And one of the patients apparently has completely recovered, and the other one is reportedly 80% improved, might be fine by the time we're talking. But so that's what we're dealing with. And I think in the larger scheme of things, I think this is another reminder, just as I hope the pandemic it was a reminder, that we are a highly interconnected world, and we can no longer afford to just be complacent because something is happening in Asia or something is happening in Africa, but we don't see it here. How many times do we see those things eventually become problems here in the United States?
So let's talk about that a little bit, Dr. Pate, because I think this ringworm strain kind of puts that, you know, under a spotlight right now. But I mean, we have long seen things like MRSA, right? And maybe, I mean, at least within your profession, you have been aware of that. You've seen it. This seems to kind of come to the forefront when there's some type of outbreak. But then, you know, then we see MRSA sometimes. We've seen that, like when you check into the hospital, right? They ask you if you have that. So can you talk a little bit about these viruses, rather, or I guess infections that become drug resistant to things like antibiotics? Because that's I find that to be a bit concerning, because that's for so long, that's kind of your go-to when there's an issue.
Well, Gemma, first of all, I'm glad you find this concerning because it's concerning to me. And second, I applaud you for taking time on your show to raise awareness about this issue because it is not getting the attention that it needs. And it's frustrating to healthcare providers and public health professionals when we think about the amount of time consumed in our state and federal legislatures on divisive issues and issues that seem to be answers in search of a problem. When we have some really legitimate problems and concerns that we need to be addressing. And antimicrobial resistance is one of those. I suspect within the next decade that this will be a huge issue. And so to your point, going back, you're right. This is a problem that has been a growing problem for a long time. You mentioned MRSA. MRSA is methicillin-resistant Staph aureus, Staphylococcus aureus. And so most people just know this by staph. And so it's a bacteria. And what we started seeing decades ago was people having outbreaks of pustules, pus-filled bumps that are red and painful. And we were able to tie this to hospitals, to gymnasiums, other places where it was resistant to the normal antibiotics we used so long ago that now don't seem so normal because we can't use them anymore, like some of our simple penicillins. Antibiotics were a miracle breakthrough and helped us treat so many bacterial illnesses that are serious and reduce those mortalities from bacteria. However, with our use has come growing resistance. And that resistance is due to a number of things. First of all, there are some natural mechanisms by which bacteria can achieve resistance to antimicrobials in nature. In fact, I think just in the last couple of weeks, found an amazing discovery of how this can happen in soil, which I won't go into it because it's complicated, but it's just really staggering the ability of microorganisms and pathogens to evolve. And so one thing is they have a natural tendency, but the other is when we use antibiotics too much or too little or inappropriately, we're prompting this along because the bacteria are evolving accordingly. So many of, you know, I remember the days it used to be a real problem for doctors when we first started about this problem, because we know in the vast majority of situations, antibiotics are not going to be effective against viruses. And if you think about primary care doctors and urgent care, most of the infections we see are viruses and viral illnesses, and people want to be prescribed an antibiotic because they want to feel better soon. And we know how quickly you get better with antibiotics if it's a bacteria. But the problem is when doctors have often caved to that pressure because the mother or patient's not going to be satisfied unless they get that prescription, we're using way too much antibiotics. The other problem is anybody who's been prescribed antibiotics probably has been warned, number one, be sure you complete the course, even if you feel better. One of the problems is if you take the antibiotics too short of a period of time, you will get the bacteria to stop growing and you may feel better, but you haven't killed it. And so then it can come back and now acquire the ability not to be treatable with those antibiotics. So finish your course of antibiotics. The other thing is people taking antibiotics too long. So we have situations where people will finish the course, but then they've got some extra or something laying around. They'll take extra. That's not good either. And then, of course, another situation is where people just either, you know, trade their antibiotics or offer them without a doctor being involved in that decision. Or we know of countries where you can just walk into pharmacies and buy antibiotics. Unfortunately, the choice of the proper antibiotic is very complicated, and a layperson's not going to be able to do that effectively in most cases. And if we use antibiotics that aren't appropriate, we'll just drive more of this. And then there's many other reasons, but I'll just mention one more, and that is because we're putting a lot of antibiotics into our food sources, and we don't quite understand yet all the connections, but it's very likely that we're making this problem worse, not better.
Okay, so with all that said, Dr. Pate, then what is best practices? Maybe as someone who, you know, gets an infection and maybe the go-to has been an antibiotic. I mean, I'll give you an example. Like when my oldest, between the ages of about, probably about six months to about 2 years old, he had recurring ear infections. We did not want to do tubes. So we did antibiotics when he would get an ear infection. The kid hasn't probably had an antibiotic since after that, maybe once or twice, right? He's 15 now. But what is there a different course of treatment? Or, I mean, should you be advocating more, I guess, as a patient? But what are you advocating for? More antibiotics or less antibiotics?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, exactly. So that's a good point. So first of all, the thing I would advocate for is talk to your physician, or if you're seeing a nurse practitioner or whoever you're seeing for your treatment, physician assistant, whatever, talk to them about, first of all, how certain are they that this, whatever the illness is caused by bacteria. So for example, many people get earaches or get sinusitis or sore throats and those kinds of things. And in the vast majority of those cases, it's actually not caused by a bacteria. So you don't want to take an antibiotic in that case. So ask the provider, how likely is this a bacteria, or do you think this is a virus? If they're not certain, it depends on how sick the person is. Sometimes we want to get antibiotics started right away just in case, but we have ways we can do. We can do strep tests. We can do cultures. Mm-hmm. There's various things we can do. And what we want to make sure that we do is when we are using antibiotics, if we do one of those tests, we'll want to check to see what antibiotics it is sensitive to, meaning that the antibiotics will kill that bacteria. And what we want to do is narrow down don't give an antibiotic that goes after 100 different kinds of bacteria. Give, you know, tailor it to that particular infection. And then make sure that if the provider does tell you, yes, you need to take the antibiotics, take it exactly as prescribed for exactly how long. Don't miss doses. Don't cut it short. And don't take extra without your provider recommending it. I also want to mention that it's not just bacteria. During this time, Gemma, when we've been talking about COVID, how many times have we discussed new variants becoming resistant to our monoclonal antibodies, to the vaccines, the so-called immune evasion? Viruses do this too. They do it in a very different way, but they, over time, they also acquire resistance to certain treatments. And so that can happen. And then you'll remember just a few weeks ago, I think, on this show, we talked about a far more concerning fungus than that ringworm. We talked about Candida auris. And that has been in the United States. It's in, there's a lot more of it than this resistant tinea. And whereas that, I'm sorry, trichophyton. And whereas there is, you know, typically we've got good options still for that new resistant ringworm. We don't have many options for the Candida auris. And it's been in the news that there's a significant problem in hospitals and long-term care facilities in Las Vegas. That's not far away from here. And of course, this is something we haven't experienced a problem in Idaho yet, but I have no doubt that it's coming.
All right. Well, I really appreciate this conversation, Dr. Pate. I mean, as you said, I don't think we know enough about this as lay people, so appreciate your perspective on this because we probably should be getting ourselves more educated on it. So really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you for highlighting this.
Absolutely. We've been talking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System. Now remember, if you have any questions regarding public health, get those questions to us. You can email us, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And of course, Dr. Pate will be back next week to answer those questions. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Two men of color vanished after last being seen in the same deputy's patrol car.
I knew something was wrong. Your mother knows.
It's the strangest case, the most unsettling case.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR Network.